Hey everyone, it's Phil, and in this episode, you are going to learn how to ask questions that make massive differences to the way that you approach partnerships and relationships in general. Jeff Wetzler is an expert in this field, and you are going to love how to ask better questions. Let's dive in straight away. All right, so everyone, we have the great pleasure to talk to Jeff today. I'm going to leave all of the background and all the wonderful things that he's achieved in his career to date to him to tell us a little bit about. But there will be a TED Talk linked below in the show notes. There is a link to a book that he has written about curiosity and asking questions. And when it comes to partnerships, there is this intersection, as we just talked about before we jumped on, that is absolutely crucial to how business partnerships can be discovered, can be formed, and can really prosper. So, Jeff, thank you for spending the time with me today. I'm super pumped for this conversation.
I love the topic of partnerships, and it's great to be with you, Phil.
So let's dive right in, because education for you is a very significant part of your world, both in the work that you do, the organizations you've helped co-found, but also in the books you've written. But you came from a very different place, from a place of management consulting. And you know, you're a board member and advisor to many organizations. So let's start with a bit of the backstory to give some context. And then why did you end up landing on education as the place to spend a lot of time?
Great. Yes, my career has really been a toggle between the business world and the education world, and the common thread is learning. I personally believe learning is the most important superpower that we all need in this fast-changing world. It is one of the things that I am most passionate about in life. And so for me, getting to apply that both in the world of business, but also in the world where the business is learning, which is the business of education, has just felt like a natural fit. As you mentioned, I did start my career in management consulting at a place called Monitor Group, which was a global consulting firm, which is now part of Deloitte. It's called Monitor Deloitte. I was drawn to Monitor in part because there was a leader there who was one of the pioneers of the field of organizational learning and really organizational behavior. His name was Chris Argyris, and he was obsessed with a question, which is, how is it that sometimes the smartest, most educated, most, quote, successful people are the worst at learning, and especially the worst at learning from other people as well? And Chris really dissected that question, but he was not the kind of researcher who was satisfied to just give an explanation. He wanted to intervene and change it. He wanted to actually, in his words, teach smart people how to learn. And I became fascinated by that. And he became a mentor of mine, as well as other people that got to work with him also mentored me. And over the years, I had the opportunity to actually teach a lot of his methods to Monitor's consultants and clients around the world. And consistently, people would say, this is the most powerful day, or this is the most powerful stuff I've ever seen, not just for my business relationships, but for my relationship with my spouse, or my father, or my son, or those kinds of things. And I can say that with, you know, without any sheepishness, because I didn't invent it. I simply inherited it. And I had the opportunity to teach it. And over the years, I built upon it and expanded upon it. But at that time, I just realized I had stumbled on pure gold. And so had the opportunity to just really kind of test it out, learn on it, do some innovation around it for almost a decade at Monitor. And I'll just pause there for a second and see if you want to jump in.
Listen, I have so much to dive in just on that topic alone, because the idea of how almost biologically the way that organisms learn to coexist, and then you think about, you know, small family units and then cultures and then organizations and how we think things are real or not real. And, you know, there's so many different places that this is just a point of fascination. I know that you have kids. I have kids as well, and we are helping them grow up in a place and time where there's extraordinary change, where even, you know, the frame of reference our parents had for us is so vastly different compared to the frame of reference we have for our kids.
Yes.
And just trying to be curious and learn through that as well, it just adds another layer on that. So I'm not surprised at all to hear that these kind of days that you would spend, or, you know, engagements you would spend with these clients, is actually transformative beyond the walls Definitely. Of their professional context.
Yes. One of the methods that Chris invented is called the two-column case. And he used to say to people, I want you to bring me some data about a challenging interaction that you've had that is representative of the kinds of interactions that you want to get better at handling. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want you to bring it to me in a very particular format. So take out a sheet of paper, draw a line down the middle. And on the right-hand side, I want you to tell me all of the things that you said. And then what did they say? And then what did you say? Almost as if you were writing out the script of a play of a tough moment in the conversation. On the left-hand side, which he called the left-hand column, I want you to tell me all the things that you were thinking and feeling, but not saying during that conversation. And so that was really a window into people's unspoken, what they don't tell one another. And over the years, I had the chance to read hundreds and hundreds of these. And it was like getting an X-ray vision into the real things that people are actually thinking and feeling. And once you clear away the junk and the clutter and the venting and whatever else, I started to realize there's some very important things that people are not saying to one another. Mm-hmm. Things like, this is why no one wants to work for you. Or this is where your plan is going to fail that you don't want to hear. Or here's a new idea that would actually be a breakthrough if you would only listen. You know, those kinds of things that if people actually found out could make an enormous difference. They would save time. They would have made better decisions. They would have innovated together. Their partnerships and relationships would be better, but they never found it out because it stayed stuck in the other person's left-hand column. And so I got fascinated by this. What are the things that people aren't telling us and why do they keep them in the left-hand column? And what could be possible if we could tap into that?
And it's extraordinary that we're not really taught the tool at a very early age to work out how to traverse the left to the right column, right?
That's like right.
I find that just, you know, you almost feel as though children have, and maybe it's just a lack of, that they have no inhibition around or knowledge or a social norm to know not to say things in certain contexts, right? But then you end up with these very profound, often very simple statements, questions, observations from children. You sort of go, yeah, I think you might be right.
Exactly.
I'm not quite sure what to do with this now, but I think you're probably right. So can we just pull that apart a little bit? Because, you know, when you think about asking the questions, hoping that somebody else is going to be open to responding, but maybe a context stops them from doing that for fear of reputation, for fear of not looking like somebody who's got all the answers. You know, we spend a lot of time, I'm sure you do as well, trying to fine tune that as an art, because, you know, every moment you could apply the left column, right column circumstance, but there's obviously a time and a place. How do you help people understand how to really bring that to life? Because I think this is such a core skill that I frankly wish I would have learned, you know, in my teenage years so I could pull it into the first half of my career. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah. So I think when things are getting stuck in the left-hand column in both directions, when people are not being direct with each other, and lots of companies will say to me, like, we just don't have a culture of directness, or we don't have a culture of honest feedback or candor with each other, you can kind of come at it from two sides. One side is, how do you get people to be more courageous and more skillful at saying the things that they're keeping private in their left-hand column? And there's lots of great books on that. One of my favorites is Radical Candor, but there's lots of good ones.
Sure.
I come at it from the other side, which is how do we better invite people to tell us the things that they're not telling us? And I personally come at it from that. And I, by the way, I don't think one is right and the other is wrong. I think both are valuable. And when you put them together, it's incredibly powerful. Personally, I have always found that when there's something that I'm not telling someone else, it's so much easier for me to get it out if I know that they want to hear it and if they skillfully invite it out of me. And so that's why I picked the side of how do we actually lower the barriers to people telling us what they really think and feel and know, as opposed to try to pushing people to sort of say the thing when they're not sure if the other person actually wants to hear it or know it or that type of thing.
It's that point of invitation is critical. I mean, I count the number of times I've been brought in to help almost semi-mediate an implication inside a very mission critical partnership. And there has been, you look at the people around the table and they are chomping at the bit to want to be able to, get out of that left column, because there is so much that needs to be exchanged. And of course there needs to be an order and a, you know, a grace that is afforded to that, because there was originally an intent for which you entered that partnership. It's not as though you're there to be combative.
Yes.
There is a need to work through that, but it becomes such a difficult quagmire given all the politics, all of the things that can be going on to stop that. And I find that method you're talking about such a beautifully elegant and simple way of sort of trying to find ways to help people do the inviting of that.
Yes. And I think when people do it well, the other person who has been withholding something is at ease, and they actually want to share. Right. They want to contribute. Yep. They want to know that it's going to be received in a constructive way. But it also gives the other person a chance to be more self-expressed about something that they have been withholding. And I think that act of asking and inviting and making it safe and making it easier, to me, is a great gift that we give to the other person as well.
In your TED talk, you made a very poignant observation about you jumping into an Uber, seeing a symbol both on the back of the vehicle and inside a garment that the driver was wearing. Yes. It was about police and that person's support for police and the work they do. And I'd love if you wouldn't mind recounting part of the discovery process you went through that, because it landed so well in terms of how curiosity plays a huge role and the courage, frankly, that you need to have to exercise that curiosity to move down a track that could be very frightening if you take that decision to ask questions and learn more about why somebody supports something. Can you just maybe give the truncated version of that experience? Sure. Because it is such an important one that I think our listeners would love to hear.
Sure, happy to. And the specifics of the symbol don't really matter. But suffice it to say, there was a symbol on the driver's hat, and also, as you said, on his bumper sticker, that made me conjure up all kinds of stories about this person. That this was a person who didn't respect humanity, that didn't share my values, that was a bad person in the world, all kinds of things that I instantly jumped to just by focusing in on this one symbol and ignoring all kinds of other things that were going on in the car and with this person. And I just essentially jumped very quickly to a very strongly held story that if I was not stuck in this person's car for 45 minutes, I would have just had that story and walked off and dismissed this person and probably felt self-righteous about how much better a person I am than this other person. Mm-hmm. But seeing, and initially I was pretty uncomfortable and even a little bit frightened to be stuck in a car with this person for 45 minutes. But then something in me clicked, and I made a shift to say, how often do I actually get to talk to someone with such a different worldview? Maybe this could be interesting. Maybe there's something I could learn here from this person. And that mental shift to say there's something I can learn from this person, I think is one of the most powerful mental shifts that any of us can make in any kind of relationship that we have, especially when things are difficult. And so I offer in the talk this idea of, can we center on what can I learn from this person? And once I was able to make that shift, I started to ask him some questions. I said, hey, you know, I noticed your hat. Tell me the story. And the story that this person shared with me about his experience in the police force, about the ways in which he was actually incredibly committed to treating other people with dignity, and to doing the very things that I would never have expected him to actually say or think or do, completely blew me away. Not just in my relationship with him, but also in my conception of the symbol and my conception of police and my conception of people who I think are, you know, different than me in some way, that I will never be the same for having had that, you know, 45 minutes of my life conversation. And I can tell you, I am so grateful that he had the grace to engage me in that conversation as well.
The idea of walking into every conversation with that question, what can I learn from this conversation? Almost physically written at the top of the notebook page for that meeting is such an important way to maintain a curiosity, as opposed to we're having the same meeting, we're going into the same conversation, there's going to be a similar kind of tempo, which is likely to be boring. it does change it so profoundly. So let's sort of take that story from that Uber drive into your book, Ask, and the approach that lives inside that. Because what I would love anyone who is listening, who is in a partnerships position, whether you're a chief executive and you're a long way removed from a particular partnership, or you're someone who's forging this, I think this approach is fundamental to collapsing the time to trust, because yes, the curiosity breeds insight, which then breeds more trust that then breeds progress. So walk us through that, Jeff. I'm very keen to understand, help people understand this for them.
Thank you. So the book essentially starts with the premise that anybody, every one of us is surrounded by people who have things in their left-hand columns, who have ideas, insights, feedback, perspectives for us that if we found them out, we would be better off together. We would make better decisions together. We would have deeper relationships, et cetera. But that chances are, for a whole bunch of reasons, we're not finding out some of the most important things that these people think and feel and know. And in essence, you could say everyone in our life has the potential to be a learning partner for us, but far too often they're not. And so the book talks about what are the most common patterns of things that people are not telling you, and what are the biggest barriers that stop them from telling you. And I think it's important to start there just to understand how pervasive this phenomenon is, how overdetermined the phenomenon is. But the core of the book is to say, what can we do about it? And so I introduce a methodology called the ASK approach. And the ASK approach is research-backed, practice-tested in many different contexts. And it's five learnable steps that we can all undertake, that we can all practice to maximize the chances that we really can learn what we most need to find out from people who are often unlikely to tell us. So do you want me to walk you through the five
practices? Let's do it. This is awesome. Let's go.
Okay, great. So number one is called choose curiosity. And that is that switch that flipped in me in that back of the Uber to say, I'm shifting from thinking I'm the righteous, I'm the better person, I'm, you know, whatever, to there's something I can learn. And it's a recognition that there is something important to learn from every single person. And that this kind of curiosity is not a trait that some people have and other people lack. It's not a state of mind that we're stuck in. I'm curious, or I'm just not curious today. It's a decision. It's a choice that's always available to us. And very simply, when we make the choice to choose curiosity, we center in that, in our minds, that question, what can I learn from this person? And when we center that question, it pushes away other questions like, why are they such a jerk? Or why are they so stupid? Or how do I get them to do this? And instead, it opens new questions. It opens the space for new questions to come in, like, well, what do they see that I don't see? Or how might they look at this situation? Or what's motivating them? Or how am I impacting them? Those are the questions that start to become present in our minds. And when we feel genuinely curious, I believe we radiate an energy that leads people to want to share with us. I have a mentor. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is, it feels, the energy feels uplifting. It feels as though it will awaken you even when you might be fatigued for any number of life-related reasons.
Exactly.
It does feel as though, there might be something here. And I think there's this tension, and we have a value in one of my businesses, which is about the genuine fear of missing out an important perspective. And whether you're driven by that fear or whether you come at it with, I'm just genuinely curious, I'll be honest, I'm not really worried which way it comes.
Sure.
I just want you to sort of show up with that intent.
Exactly. You got it. That is choosing curiosity and the impact it has. So that's number one. Then number two is called make it safe. And it's a recognition that even if I'm curious to learn from you, if you don't feel safe to tell me your truth, especially if it's a hard truth, chances are I'm not going to find this out. And I learned this the hard way as an operating leader when, you know, I thought things were going well and I was asking my team, how's it's going? And, you know, behind the scenes, things were blowing up and no one felt safe enough to tell me. Right. And I, you know, it killed me because if I had found out, I would have helped. I could have rolled up my sleeves. We could have cleared out the barriers, but people thought they needed to give me the good news. They need to make themselves look good. And so making it safe is really about making it more comfortable, easy, and appealing for others to let us know what's really going on for them. And in the book, I identify a set of strategies that I call the safety cycle that help us to make it safe, including how do we create connection and when and where do we create connection with other people? How do we open up first so that they're not guessing at our agenda for asking questions? Mm-hmm. How do we do what I call radiate resilience, which is to demonstrate and let them know and show them through our behaviors that we can handle their truth.
Yeah.
Even for example, I have a former colleague who used to say, please give me your most critical feedback on this. And when he would ask me that question, I knew he could handle my truth. Yeah. He was not looking for, you know, just some compliments or whatever. So there's a whole set of ways that we can enact each of those strategies that's part of the safety cycle, all about making it safe. Number three is called pose quality questions. This is the heart of the ask approach. And this is a recognition that not everything that has a question mark is a quality question. A lot of what we think are questions or what passes for questions, I call crummy questions. These are questions that block learning, that lead people to feel manipulated or confused or attacked. My favorite is just when someone will say something and they'll say, isn't that right? And they may genuinely think they want to know, do you agree with it? But it's a very difficult thing for someone to disagree with when you formulate the question that way. I call that a clumsy question, as all distinct from a quality question. And you know, one of the things that you said earlier that I really agree with is we don't teach people how to ask quality questions. And I think it's fascinating because most of us in our life spend our, you know, one form or another having conversations, whether in work or life, which is all just about making statements and asking questions. And yet no one ever teaches us the difference between a quality question and a crummy question, or the fact that there is an actual learnable taxonomy of different quality question strategies. And it's not infinite. There's probably a dozen of them. If we could master that dozen, we would learn so much more. You know, one of my favorite of the, you know, of that taxonomy is a strategy called request reactions. And request reactions is just to simply, you know, explain something to someone or give them feedback or offer a direction and then say, hey, what's your reaction to that? How does that land with you? What does that make you think? How does that sit with you? What might I be missing? Any of those is a strategy that essentially invites the other person's thinking about our thinking. So if there's gaps in our thinking, or if our thinking, if they disagree with our thinking, or if they have something new to say, we're far more likely to find that out than if we don't ask that. Or if we ask a question like, does that make sense? Or isn't that right?
Mm. I get that. And it's funny, isn't it? Because the desire to want to move quickly on anything is often truncated by those kind of pseudo confirmatory questions that don't really allow the space to actually respond to whatever it is that's there. And I'm guilty of that. I mean, I think there's plenty of people who have gone, I just need you to see my point of view. I'm going to dangle out there a kind of question that kind of semi keeps the door ajar, but it's actually not a real door.
Yeah.
It's just going to slam a little bit shut just as you get to the point of crafting an answer to my question. I think we could all do a lot better than that.
Right. And you know, I have a mentor who says, you know, you can either pay now or pay later. So if the other person disagrees with you or is demotivated by what you say or whatever, and you think, oh, I'm saving time, I don't want to hear that, you're going to pay later. You're going to pay three times as much later versus if you take the extra maybe 30 seconds that you know it takes to ask the question and find out, did it land?
I love that. I feel as though I'm going to go reread your book again. I need to relearn some of this.
I do think this taxonomy of questions, when I talk to groups and organizations, that's the thing that people say, can you print that out? Can I put that in front of my computer or whatever? Because it's just very tactical and concrete and learnable. So anyways, that's number three. Number four is called listen to learn. And that essentially means that no matter how good your questions are, it all comes down to, do you actually hear the answers? Right. And there's a big difference between listening to learn and listening to prove a point, or listening to look smart, or listening to be right, or listening to get out of here. And most of us think we're listening, and we're not actually listening. And so listening to learn is bringing that back, that intention to say, what's the most important things that someone is telling me, and how do I really hear them? And to not just listen for the content of what someone's saying, but also to be listening for the emotion of what they're saying and displaying and the actions that they're taking. So this idea of listening for content, emotion, and actions essentially triples the amount of information that we hear in a conversation. And most of us are, I think, given to one or the other. I tend to first go to content. And so I've had to train myself to say, how do I listen for emotion? How do I listen for action? as well in a conversation. And when you can do that, it's kind of analogous to when a music aficionado can hear a piece and they can hear the drums and the vocals and the harmony and the violin and whatever else it may be. It's just a much richer piece. And so when I do this with people, I will play a clip from a meeting or a show and say, listen for content. Now listen for emotion. Now listen for action. And the differences of what people take away are fascinating.
It is fascinating. Tell me, you know, whenever you're in a meeting and you see, or a conversation, you see somebody reach to take a note for something that's just been said, because it's obviously struck a chord, and they're writing down whatever the scribble is that has gone on the page or on the iPad or whatever else to sort of anchor back to that. Is there a way for somebody, and I ask this question because often I will come back from a meeting and I will see what I've written and I can't anchor back to the content easily. It was some scribble that it was two words, and I look back and I just go, oh, I know that was important. Now I've got to really dig hard to get back to the relevance of that. I'm wondering whether, given what you've just described, is there any kind of model you're aware of that if you were to write a note to highlight something that was very important in a conversation that came as a consequence of listening like you've described, is there a way to make a note or to make that relevant so when I come back and visit it tomorrow, the next day, the next week, that it actually holds the same gravity or gives me a good reminder?
So I have an interpersonal strategy and a technology strategy for you.
I'd love to hear it, because this is one of those tactical things that happens to me quite a bit.
So I don't know if you've been in conversations, but sometimes in conversations, I will say this or someone else will say this. You know, let's say that you've said something that I think is particularly important that I might scribble down. I think a move that you can make is to also say, what you just said is so important. I want to just check. I want to say it back to you and check. Reflection. Did I hear that right? And I want to underscore. I want to stamp it for myself. I want to actually just make sure that I've really captured it. Mm-hmm. I think doing that makes it stickier in your own mind. Also might give you a chance to write down more than just one or two words. And if you can follow it by saying, and tell me a little bit more about that, you can get a little bit more of the context around it, all of which I think helps to really, make it stick for you. And further sends the other person a message. Wow, that's really, they really care about what I have to say. Because it is validating to see someone take a note, but it's even more, I think, affirming when they actually tell you back and say, what does it mean to them as well?
Yes. That's it. It's super helpful. Thank you. That's a very selfish question to ask, but thank you.
I love it. And the technology, I'll just say, you know, these note takers with whether, you know, AI or whether, you know, on video chat, or there's, you know, a bunch that I'm using now, I think are fascinating, because they allow, you know, then you can literally just get the transcript and you can put those two words that you scribbled into it and you can say, take me back to that moment of the conversation, and you can get the two paragraphs. And I think that's just pretty powerful too.
It's very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. The final step of the ask approach is called reflect and reconnect. This is my favorite, because I am a junkie for learning, as we established at the beginning. And reflection is really how we learn. Mm-hmm. Reflection is how we squeeze the insight out of our experiences, and we convert the insight into action. And I think a lot of us think, I don't have time for reflection. I'd have to go on some, you know, meditation retreat if I really want to reflect. But in this step, I try to make reflection just very simple and pragmatic. And I talk about a method called sift it and turn it. So sift it is basically to say, you know, if somebody said to me 30 things in the course of a conversation, let me just go back through my notes or through my memory and sift out what are the three or four most important things that I take away from this conversation. And sometimes it helps to sift it with a friend or a coach or a mentor, so I don't sift the wrong things. But sifting is really important, because not everything that someone said is equally important. Some things are just not valuable for us to pay attention to or take in. So sifting it and then turning it is just to simply say, let me turn it over in my mind three times. The first time is to say, how does what they said affect my story? Like in that Uber ride, I had a new story about the person based on that. The second is, what steps can I take based on that? Is there something different that I can do based on what I learned? And the third is there something here that affects my deeper stuff that maybe sheds some light on a bias that I have or an assumption that I was holding or a way of being? And so turning it for your story, your steps, and your stuff is a way to really squeeze the learning out of it. And then I call it reflect and reconnect, because that reconnection, I think, is the most important part of the whole thing, which is to go back to the person and say, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for taking the risk. Here's what I learned from you. Here's what I'm going to do about what I learned from you. How does that line up to what you were hoping I would learn? Is there anything different you would have wanted me to take away from the conversation? And that really sends the message to the other person, like, you didn't waste your time. And look how powerful you are in terms of influencing me and how much I value you. And I think it radically increases the chance that they're going to want to continue to share over time. That's a very quick flyover of the five steps of the ask approach. No,
that's extraordinary, Jeff. Can we just double click on something you just said before about thank you for taking the risk?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons why people might hesitate to tell us things or say things to us. And the biggest one is the fear of the impact that it could have. The impact it could have on us, maybe we will get upset or defensive or hurt. The impact it could have on them, maybe it will make them look stupid. The impact it could have on our relationship, maybe it'll put tension. Right. So people have all kinds of fear. And thanking them for taking a risk as a way of just acknowledging it might not have been easy to tell me that. And it's not, I'm not necessarily assuming it felt hard, but if it felt risky, thank you for going there. Right. And I think it's a way of radiating resilience, of letting them know how much I value hearing things, even hard things too.
It is fascinating because when we talk about partnerships, we do talk about this idea of risk in a very different context, which I think goes to what you're saying. When somebody brings another party into the organization, so the champion for a new partnership into another organization, we refer to this idea that they're playing one of their promise cards. And the risk that they're taking is they're putting, like, let's say we get issued, you know, 5 or 10 of these cards in our entire career. You're putting one of these cards on the table and you're saying, the organization can trust me to bring you into the organization. And I'm putting that card down. Now, I only get to pick that card back up again if the risk I've taken pays off. In other words, the partnership works, right? Yes. If it doesn't work, then I burn that card and a little bit of my reputation, my political capital also gets burned with that card and I can't get it back. Yes. So the idea of trying to find the way to establish the first win, the first evidence that a partnership's working well, is the first glimpse you get to see of that card coming back into your deck. And that is something that is, I think, quite poignant to what you talked about, because a lot of these conversations that lead to partnerships, we'll get to transcend in a second, really start with somebody offering an insight at personal risk to themselves that otherwise, if they wouldn't have offered that, there's a good chance the partnership wouldn't have started or moved in any direction. And so I
think that metaphor.
Yeah, there's something really interesting about that.
And I also think it applies even to teams and interpersonal relationships, which is I only have so many risks I'm going to take with you to see how you're going to react before I'm out of cards as well.
Yep.
Exactly. And so essentially you never, I just thought of this as you're saying that, but you know, this reflect and reconnect is almost like marking, okay, that card can go back in your deck now.
Yep.
It was a risk worth taking.
Yes. And the, I think a sign perhaps of a career well-lived or careers well-lived, as most people are going to go through multiple careers, is that you end that chapter with a full deck of cards, right?
And if
you end up with only a couple there, I really hope that that's just yielded a massive amount of learning. So for whatever comes next, you get issued another type of card, but you're going to hold on to more of those.
Yeah. Wow. That's deep. I love that.
Yeah, it's good fun. All right. Now, let's talk about Transcend Education. And this is where we can get gritty into some of the partnership work that you've done because, you know, trying to innovate with education systems, which in the United States, you know, a lot of systems, like we, you know, from looking from the Australian perspective out to the United States, we often forget that the United States is ultimately a confederation of states that have very different rules within the borders of each state, which means that the capacity to do innovation and to scale that can become very difficult. But there are pockets of the United States that are forever innovating and are doing really fantastic work versus others that might not be. I'm wondering, when you think about the work that Transcend is there to do, and when we did the reading for this, it was not just around curriculums, it was about the communities that surround the school, the learning experience, the teaching experience, like the entire experience chains that you could imagine in a school, which are complex and made even more complex by technology and COVID and post-COVID and all the things. When you think about the massive opportunity that your organization has to have an impact, you can't be everywhere all the time. So what is your partnership philosophy when it comes to wanting your organization to genuinely partner and have an impact with your customers?
Yeah, good. Well, the first thing I'll say is that this idea of partnership is so deeply central to Transcend's work. We don't even call the school communities that we work with customers or clients. We call them partners. And we do that deliberately because we think we're not here with the answers just to come in and drop what the right answer in as leave or and we don't want to be seen as a vendor. We really want to be seen as partners in transformation. And we believe that the heroes of that transformation process, which we call a design journey, are the young people and the educators and the families of that community.
Right.
And we have a process and we have some knowledge and some insights and whatever. But really, it's the blending of the two things that we do that is the partnership. When it works well, that's exactly how it goes. Now, to your point, there are over 100,000 school communities in the United States, and there's no way that our organization has about 125 people full time. There's no way that we're going to be able to make a dent in that alone. Yeah. And so we are now sort of in this next era of our strategy, essentially working to build the capacity of other organizations who have their own expertise at how to work with school communities all across the country through a vehicle called Transcend Institute, so that they can take the best of what they have and know and blend it with the best of what we have to offer in that kind of joint venture and that kind of partnership, both so that they can be that much more impactful in their context, but also we can expand our reach and impact too.
Clever. And so when we get into your way of thinking about a partnership, that's excellent for Transcend. I mean, the idea of going with a learning lens is critical. Let's dive into a partnership that you have enjoyed creating, and it could be at the institute level, it could be at a school community level. I'd love to break down and to almost reverse engineer why it was so great, because often we hear two things in partnerships. One is, this was extraordinary. It literally changed the game for our organization, our market, our industry. Sadly, that's in a minority. What we generally hear is the partnership failed. It just didn't live up to the expectation, or something in between, which was less than ideal. So what's a great partnership that we can break down from your point of view?
Yeah. I feel so grateful to have had the opportunity to be in so many long-term partnerships. I was just thinking about which one to share. I think I'll share about a partnership with a school district in California called Lindsay Unified School District, which we have worked with almost since the beginning of the organization. And we're about a decade old now in various forms. And the partnership started off with a relatively bounded and concrete project where we were helping Lindsay and actually one other system examine and codify aspects of their design that they thought were particularly powerful so that they could share them with other people in the world. I would say in that stage of the partnership, the most important thing that we were trying to do, honestly, was to do a good job, was to help them really be successful and to get a good product out there in the world, while also demonstrating to them that we have some capability and we have some competence that they can trust and that can be good for what they were to do. And when that project ended and it was successful, we sat down at various levels, including myself and the superintendent, someone named Tom Rooney, and we said, we really value each other. We really enjoy working together. What's the next thing that we could do together? And we literally got in a room and we just dreamed together. And we did not know where it was going to go. We did not know, if anything was going to come out of it. We did not know where the money would come from to pay for it. But we said, we think there's something special that we could do together. What might it be? And we invited a bunch of other people in the room with us to think with us together with literally no expectation about what would happen. And actually what came out of that was a leadership development program called the Learner-Centered Leadership Lab, which essentially was an opportunity to help other superintendents in other districts who wanted to do the same kinds of things that this district called Lindsay Unified was doing to foster their own leadership. And so we started by just saying, let's pilot it and see what happens. Let's just get a half dozen other superintendents together and try putting on this programming and a little bit co-create it. And that was 7 years ago. And, you know, now we've now gone through 6 national cohorts of this program, and then many of the people who went through it then have replicated the program locally inside their districts as well. So I'd say probably over 100 leaders across the country, whether nationally or locally, have now developed their leadership just through this idea that got seeded by saying, we really enjoy partnering together. What's the next thing we might do? And we've subsequently had that conversation multiple times. That has led to many more layers of this partnership as well.
I love that. And you know, 3 really important things. I mean, there are very few times where strategic self-improvement is not a good thing, right?
Yes.
And when you think about leaders, you'll often hear about leadership development training and everything else, but when it's context specific, and I love the idea it's for superintendents, right? Like it is a specific lonely role that is critical to the success of any system, right? In education.
Yes. Totally.
And it's like, yes, can we please invest in you? Like it's a no-brainer to want to invest in them. The second one is the idea of, you know, you're able to sort of look back 10 years. Anytime we're thinking about helping an organization build the same capability around partnerships, it is have a 10-year lens. It might only last for 2 years. Like the practical relationship might only be foreseeable for 2 years, maybe 3, but think about it in 10. And the idea finally of, you know, is it a partnership born from logic or is it born from instinct? And there'll be so many people that say, look, we have to have logic. Like if I can't see an NPV, if I can't see some kind of return and one singular metric, then I can't do it. And in some cases it's real, right? It's got to be grounded in that kind of logic. But my experience is that instinct plays a much more over and much more important role than people often give it credit for. And it's only because they don't have the language to express the instinct.
I love that point. Yeah.
You know, so I think it's really, really, really important.
And I think on that last point, it's not like there's not a place for logic. You know, in our partnership, we had to ultimately find the money and we had to ultimately have metrics and prove impact and all, you know, all of those important things. But it did start with instinct, and it was an instinct rooted in trust, an instinct rooted in the relationship, and an instinct rooted in a sense of possibility. Is there something we can do here that's bigger than either one of us that could actually serve others? And if we can find that, then everything else should follow from it.
Right. When you think about, you know, not every partnership, and I think it's fair to say that, you know, partnership should not be smooth sailing. Right. If there is an intention from both sides to make this really, really work, at some point there'll be maybe not a trough of sorrow, but certainly there'll be areas where it'll be difficult because there'll be mixed perspectives. What kind of objections did you have to try and negotiate with this person, with that system, to make sure that it could sustain over time? Because people will look back on that quite romantically and forget about the difficult conversations, the finding of the finance, all the things that would make it work, because it would seem atypical from, you know, a normal sort of day or week or month or year in that school system's life.
Yeah. And, you know, and I, it's hard to even speak about the partnership without calling out Tom Rooney, who was the leader, who was the leader at the time, and his team, Brian and Cinnamon, all the other people that were just so crucial to the whole thing. I would say one example of a thorny question that we had to wrestle with at different times is, whose program is this? If we co-created this thing together, does this belong to my organization, Transcend? Does this belong to their organization, Lindsay? Does it spin out and become a third thing? If it's a third thing, who controls it? You know, and at different points in the partnership, we had different answers to that question.
Yep.
We started by saying we don't actually know, and then. For a while, the answer was that this is really a Lindsay thing. Like this, you know, this came out of their, you know, their vision and so on. And so this should be there. And ultimately the answer has migrated. Those kinds of questions are then, tied up in questions of intellectual property and questions of revenue and questions of cost and risk and all that kind of stuff. And so we had to work our way through those. And I would say we had to work our way through those with great patience with each other as well, yes. Recognizing that each of us was dealing with things that, bigger than that particular issue, but that, that this issue tied into as well.
It's so fascinating when people feel the need to control the outcome when the outcome could never be known at that point in time. I think the thing that we often encourage our partners to think about is, if there is the potential for a joint venture, for the love of God, do not think about a joint venture in conventional terms. Think about it as a philosophy where under no circumstance does the ownership budge from 50-50. So that is our going position, and our incentives will change as the knowledge grows. But as we get to the point where a decision actually has to be made, we can all rest easy that we will have 50-50 ownership in how that plays out. And as long as that works and you stay communicating well, I think good things can happen. I get very, very nervous when I'm brought in and the first thing that was formulated was an agreement that said, here's how it will play out. In this circumstance, this is the outcome. It's like, oh, geez, guys, we should have left the lawyers alone for a lot longer. We should have kept on going with a 50-50 philosophy as long as it took to get to a point of concrete decision, because otherwise we're burning time with a decision that doesn't need to be made yet.
Yes, I love that. I love it. I think the other thing that mattered here, and that I also find in general matters in partnerships, is a spirit that each of us is going to care for and look out for the other person's interests.
Right.
And so if this is not going well for you, that means it's not working for me either. If I can trust that we're going to do that for each other, then I have the patience to do what you're saying, which is to suspend trying to, you know, nail down all the legalities of it.
Jeff, how do you think this partnership will be remembered in a decade's time? And you're looking back and sort of reflecting on a similar question. How do you think it'll be remembered?
This particular partnership?
Right.
I think and hope it will be remembered as a transformational partnership, a partnership that literally changed the trajectory of the leadership of people who got to benefit from it, of their communities, of the students and the educators, but also a transformational partnership for each of us who is involved. I know I'm personally changed by the opportunity to be in partnership like this. I think the same is true for other people on my team, and I hope the same is true for people in Lindsay as well. And so this was not a transactional partnership. This was, you know, and I hope will continue to be remembered as a transformational one.
A lot is changing in the way that education happens right now. And I just love your hot take on how you think partnerships in education are going to evolve over the next sort of 5 or so years. It feels to me like there is a growing consciousness of the need to be involved more at a government level, at a parental level, not to oversee necessarily, but more to just pay more attention and not just have kids, you know, go to a destination in the day and then come back at the end of the day.
Exactly.
There's sort of more a need, or maybe even a desire from parents at least, to sort of be more involved. What is that nature going to look like over time, do you think, for education-related partnerships? And I know it's a big, broad question, but how are you seeing that from your vantage point?
I mean, I think just in line with what you just said, the idea that we would send a kid to a school that is kind of like a closed ecosystem all day long, and assume it's all going to get taken care of inside the walls of those schools, of that school, I think is less and less going to make sense, because we're going to see that people can learn things anytime and anywhere, and using any technology. And so the idea that a school has to have it all, has to do it all, I just think is going to be less and less relevant. And so the kinds of learning environments that I think are going to be most successful are ones that have, you know, a whole myriad of partnerships between a school and a community health center, partnerships between a school and housing and food, partnerships between a school and 10 schools in different parts of the world. And so I see the school less as a kind of a closed walled thing and more of an open walled ecosystem. And that requires the capability of really building these kinds of deep and trusting partnerships.
I agree. I think it's a great answer. You know, when to sort of round out this conversation, I could talk to you about this for a long, long time. In fact, I think we need to have a second conversation.
I'd love it.
Tell me about you know, when you see partnerships in the way that you do, and it feels like we're very aligned on how we think about these things, many leaders will continue to think about going it alone for a whole range of reasons. What do you think those kind of leaders are not seeing when it comes to the idea of partnership-driven growth?
I mean, I just think they're not seeing the possibility of exponentially greater value that can be created when you take the best of what you have and mash it up with the best of what other people have as well. It's like, you know, it's more than just 1 + 1 = 2. It's like 1 + 1 = 11. And I think that if you're just trying to go it alone, you're limited to what you know, and what you can do. And maybe that's enough. And if so, okay. You don't have to do it, but when you, but I think you're missing out on this possibility of all that could be co-created around you.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Now, Jeff, where can people find more information about you? Before we get into our 5-question rapid fire, which we'll wrap this up with, where can we send people so they can learn as much as possible from you?
Sure. So if you want to learn about me and the ASK approach, it's very simple, www.askapproach.com. And you can get everything there. I also love to connect with people on LinkedIn. So feel free to just connect with me at Jeff Wetzler. And if you want to learn about Transcend and the work that I was describing, that website is transcendeducation.org.
Awesome. All right. So a 5-question rapid fire. And look, again, we could talk for days about all of these topics, and I look forward to our next one.
Me too.
But are you ready? Can I give you these
Let's
5 questions?
Yes.
All right. Question 1, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
The first word that came to my mind is power. Partnership is power. I think it's, and I don't mean power over, like, you know, some hierarchical, you know, I have more power than you, but the power that we can have when we put the best of what we both have together is just enormous.
I love it. What content are you loving at the moment?
So I have a mentor named Diana Smith, and she recently came out with a book called Remaking the Space Between Us. And it's really about, you know, the ways in which our country and our world are increasingly polarized, and what the average person can do about that, to remake the space. So it's a book I would highly recommend.
I like that. Okay, straight to the show notes. We'll put that there as well.
Good.
What's the worst piece of advice you've received, and why?
You know, I'm really struggling with this question. And I actually believe there's some nugget inside of every piece of advice. And so I don't think there's any advice that is unilateral, you know, like uniformly bad advice. I think it's just a matter of finding what's the conditions under which that piece of advice is useful. So I don't have a better answer than that.
I think that's a very poignant observation given our context today. That's fantastic.
Okay.
Now, when you see potential for a new partnership, what do you do to turn that potential into action?
I mean, the most important thing, probably not surprisingly, I try to do is just deeply understand, quote, the other in the partnership, to understand what's in it for them. What would make this valuable for them? What are they worried about? What are they interested in? How do they see me and us in this partnership? And I feel like if I can just have as detailed and colorful as picture of their world as they see it as possible, I'm so much better off in trying to forge a partnership.
Yeah, I totally get that. And final one, what's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
Oh, so there are so many things, but my family. I can't say anything without first saying how grateful I am for my wife and my kids and my parents.
It's I share the same point of view. It's very, very fortunate. Jeff Wetzler, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you today. Everyone, look in the show notes, get into this information. We'll link to the book, ASK, which is just a critical skill set for partnerships, but just for life, particularly when you're feeling as though the world is changing faster than we can make sense of it. So, Jeff, thank you again, and I look forward to our next chat.
Thank you, Phil. This was great. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses
if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes-Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.